Well, this morning is the first Sunday of Advent, so Happy New Year, Happy New Lectionary Year. So I thought we could begin with a conversation about darkness. Cool. So why don't we do this? Turn to a neighbor, and just what comes to mind when you think of darkness? All right? Are you afraid of the dark? Do you like the dark? All right, I'll give you a couple minutes. All right. Any thoughts? Who here is afraid of the dark? Anybody? Okay, some of us. Who loves the dark? Okay. Anything come to mind when you think of darkness? What was that? No parents. Okay. Good. Anybody else? Sleep? Good. I like that. Darth Vader. A Thing Called Love. Simon and Garfunkel. All right. Says the high schoolers. I like that. So I was thinking through this a couple years ago. Actually, it was 2011. My family, we were out in Fort Davis in the Davis Mountains. And we were enjoying our time there. And people heard we were going. And so the first thing many people said to us was, you have to go to a star party at McDonald's Observatory. Anyone been? Star party. So I heard star, and I was like, there's stars and a party? I'm in. So it was probably about 40 minutes from where we were staying. And so we signed up. I think it began around 10 p.m. So we had a late dinner, kind of lounging around, just waiting for the star party to begin. I remember driving, getting in our car, and then driving on those long, narrow West Texas highways where it seems like the highway disappears in the horizon. There's a lightning storm in the distance. And it was kind of dark, and we were a little bit sleepy and tired, so we were just driving, winding up this mountain. We got there, I think Noah had fallen asleep. And I remember parking the car, getting out, and as I was closing the door and locking the car, my wife Karen was standing next to me, and she goes, hey, kid, look up. And I remember looking up, and I gasped. Like, all the air got sucked out of my body. I was like, oh! And the magnitude and the intensity and the beauty of the stars was breathtaking. I didn't take this picture, but it kind of looks like this. This is McDonald's Observatory. So if you've been out there, you know what I'm talking about. Just the intensity, the brightness of those stars. And so what's the deal with stars in West Texas? Is it that they're brighter there and they have them there and they're not over here? Or what? Why can't we see them in Austin? And you already know this. We have what we call what light pollution, right? So if you go, there's this website called Dark Sight Finder. It shows kind of the man-made manufactured light. And so for us living in Austin, which is on the far right there, we had to drive 6 or 7 hours to pursue what? Darkness. We had to drive to find the darkest of the dark, so that we could experience the beauty of the light. And so I thought it would be an interesting conversation for us on this first Sunday of Advent to explore and to be invited into darkness and to talk about that. And that's why for years the church celebrated Advent in December. Do we know why we do that? It's not because of Jesus' birthday. It's not because of coffee cup wars that we have. They did this because in December, it's the darkest time of the year. And as each week goes on, it gets darker and darker and darker till December 22nd, which is the winter solstice, the darkest day of the year. And then on December 25th, we begin to experience and celebrate the coming of light. And so I thought, well, as we enter into this season, what would it look like for us to talk about our darkness, the darkness that we're in? What could we learn from it? There's a great book called Learning to Walk in the Dark. If you're looking for a good book to read during Advent, this is a good one. Barbara Brown Taylor is the author. And this is what she says. She says, those of us who wish to draw near to God should not be surprised when our vision goes cloudy, for this is a sign that we are approaching the opaque splendor of God. If we decide to keep going beyond the point where our eyes or mind are any help to us, we may finally arrive at the pinnacle of the spiritual journey toward God, which exists in complete and dazzling darkness. And Wendell Berry says it like this, in a way that only Wendell Berry can say. He says, to know the dark, go without sight, and find that the dark too blooms and sings. And so this morning I thought, well, let's explore that together. Let's invite us as a community into this exploration of darkness. And what does it feel like? What do our seasons of darkness, what happens in them? And when we're in them, what are some things that maybe we can learn? And so we'll be in the gospel text of the lectionary this morning, which is in Luke 21. So as is our custom, just read it to a friend and then we'll jump in. All right, Luke 21, go. All right, so this morning on the first Sunday of Advent, Luke 21. So Jesus is talking here, and this is what he says. There will be signs in the sun, moon, and stars. On the earth, nations will be in anguish and perplexity at the roaring and the tossing of the sea. People will faint from terror, apprehensive of what is coming on the world, for the heavenly bodies will be shaken. And so Jesus is speaking, and he's using a tradition from his Hebrew tradition called apocalyptic. It's part of the apocalyptic tradition. And one of the biggest misconceptions of this is people use this tradition to find certainty in the future. When the Hebrew rabbis use apocalyptic literature and tradition to evoke emotion of how we should be living now. Does that make sense? So people use it to foretell the future and to give us certainty about it. You'll misread it. But we're supposed to read it and give us a sense of, oh, this is what we're supposed to be feeling now. This is what it feels like, looks like to prepare for the future. And so the word that he used there, he says there's going to be signs in the sun and the moon and the stars. So the rhythm of these things that give us day and night and structure. And then on earth, with the roaring sea, the emotion he gives is there's going to be anguish and perplexity. And I think this word perplexity, it's a decent word, right? For those of us who have been in these seasons of darkness, it feels perplexing. It feels confusing, doesn't it? And there's some of us, maybe we're in that season now, or maybe we've experienced it. I think for some of us, maybe when we were in our 20s, we imagined our next few decades and who we'd marry and where we'd live and what we'd be doing, how many babies we'd have, how many babies we wouldn't have, right? And our vocation would be clear. We had this whole course set before us, and we're a couple decades in, and none of that has happened. And we don't know who we're going to marry. We don't know why we're in Austin. We don't know what we're good at. We don't know what our vocation is. And it just feels like we're in this season of life that feels confusing, and we don't really understand it. You know, others of us, maybe we look back and faith used to feel so certain. Like faith used to be this security blanket that we would just hold and would give us all these answers. And now it just feels like we have more questions than we do answers. We have more doubt than we do faith. And we're like, yeah, this word confusion, perplexity, that kind of describes the season we're in. And what if these seasons were necessary? And what if there are these rhythms that the church understood? And let's explore these seasons of darkness and what is God doing in it, in among it when we're in it. There's another book that I would recommend in this season of Advent. The author's name is Gerald May. And he explores the dark night of the soul, which is a deep tradition within the church. And this is what he says about the dark night. So the darkest of night, the darkness of night, implies nothing sinister, only that liberation takes place in hidden ways beneath our knowledge and our understanding. He says, just because we don't understand it doesn't mean there isn't anything that's happening. It doesn't mean that God's not doing something. When I was in the Congo a couple weeks ago, on our last day, we were getting ready to leave. We were in Gemena, and we were waiting for a plane to come from another village, and they gave us a four-hour window of when our plane would arrive. So the plane's going to arrive from like 11 to 2-ish. Just hold tight. So we got the text, we headed to the airport, and then we got there, and there was this one scene that in my mind still feels kind of surreal. We were on the runway, like where all the planes were. They were trying to search our luggage, so the security guy took out our luggage and just pulling all of our stuff out. They started confiscating some of the gifts we had just brought for friends and family. And I was so tired, I had no idea what anyone was saying. And then it suddenly escalated. There was like yelling, like guys with guns started like showing up, surrounding us. Our host seemed really aggravated. And then so at one point, I think I was just so confused. I was so tired, I was starting to get sick. There was a plastic chair, and I just pulled up the chair and just sat down and started reading a book. So if you were observing the scene, this is what you would have seen. You would have seen like a group of people, lots of yelling, like planes taking off and landing behind us, which is really loud when you're next to it, lizards running all over the place, and then like a Chinese dude in a chair reading a book. So I've thought about this scene because it was weird. I was so not worried and just in that moment completely disengaged. And I thought it was strange because in real life, I'm not like that. In real life, I'm kind of an addict to control and fixing things. I love fixing things. But I think in that moment, I was so exhausted. I had zero skill sets that I could offer in any way. I had no idea what anyone was saying. And then I think the main part was I wasn't in charge. And I trusted who was in charge. And so I was like, well, I can't do anything. So I just sat down. And the president of the ECC was there. And he's one of those guys, he commands a room by whispering. Have you met people like that? So when he's about to talk, he'll whisper and the room goes quiet and everyone leans in. So I was watching, I was reading my book, I'd look up. And he didn't look worried, so I wasn't worried. And then he just waited for his moment. And then he started whispering. And then everyone shut up. And then he went into the security guy who was the most upset, whispered in his ear, and then everyone just walked away. I was like, what is going on? But I wonder if in these seasons of perplexity and confusion where we've lost intellectual control, we don't understand anymore. I wonder if it's a good space to ask in life, who's in control? And do I trust who's in control? And oftentimes, we don't allow ourselves to get there. We have to exhaust our ego. We have to exhaust our own skill set before we allow it. And I wonder if that's why Jesus took his disciples into the night, into a storm in the night, and then took a nap. And in that moment on the boat, they had to ask, who's in charge? And do I trust who's in charge? And so maybe if we're in this season of darkness, maybe that's some of us. Maybe this is a good spiritual practice for us. Go to the next slide. So when I'm in this space, if I feel confused and I have more doubt than faith, more questions than it's really hard for me to pray. I have a really tough time. But there's a practice of the church where the Psalms have just been our prayer book. And maybe in this time we can pray the lament Psalms, which is Psalm 44, Psalm 60, Psalm 74, 79, 80, 85, 90. And we'll put this on the website. But this is one of the prayers from Psalm 44. It says this, "Rouse yourself. Why do you sleep, O Lord?" And I wonder if the disciples may have prayed this psalm. Why do you sleep? Awake. Do not cast us off forever. Why do you hide your face? Why do you forget our affliction? Don't you know our affliction right now, our oppression? For we sink down to the dust. Our bodies cling to the ground. Rise up, Come to our help. Redeem us for the sake of your steadfast love. And throughout the history of the church, people would take these psalms and they would pray them. The Desert Fathers, they would pray the battle psalms. And in the battle of the turmoil, they would take that as the battle and the turmoil within themselves. And they would pray these as prayers. And so for us, maybe this time of perplexity that describes our season. All right, let's go back to our text. So in verse 29, Jesus says this, and he tells a story, tells a parable. He says, look at the fig tree and all the trees. When they sprout leaves, you can see for yourselves and know that summer is near. Even so, when you see these things happening, you know that the kingdom of God is near. So he tells a story, and he tells them to look at the trees, right? So do the trees have fruit yet in the story? No, they're fruitless. They're these barren trees. And when I read that, I was like, oh, that describes a lot of seasons I've been in, where it just feels fruitless. It feels like I can't even do anything moral or good anymore. It feels like I've come to the end of producing fruit in my faith. And it feels really disconcerting when we're there. But I propose that this is such a necessary step, but it's so frightening that many people in faith communities don't get there because they go, oh, they get there and they go, oh, I can do something moral. I can muster up something. But they never reach this point and they never go on the path towards holiness. So maybe it's like this. So hang with me for a second, okay? I'm going to give you one weird example. I'm going to connect it to the epistle text in the lectionary, and then hopefully Thomas Merton will bring this all back together, okay? So this is my weird example first. So I was listening to a podcast. Do you know who Tim Ferriss is? I didn't know who he is. He wrote a book called The 4-Hour Workweek. I started reading the book a little bit. It's not that good. It's kind of very like self-helpy. But he has a podcast, and he interviewed Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg. So they're writing partners. They're Canadian writers, comedy writers. I found this picture on Canada.com. They're a national treasure, apparently. So in this interview, they're just talking about the craft of writing. So they started writing Superbad when they were 13 years old in Toronto. Isn't that crazy? So they're talking about their craft, they're talking about film writing, their whole journey. And then 3/4 of the way into the interview, they get into this debate about writer's block. And so Evan Goldberg is adamant that writer's block doesn't exist. He's like, it's not a thing. So his thing, he says, if you say it exists, he says that means when you hit the block is implying that it's impassable. But he's saying it's not a writer's block and it's not something you avoid. He says it's just a part of the process. He's like, if you write, you're going to get there. And actually, when you get there, it often enhances creativity. So they're talking about that. They're going back and forth. And then they go, to prove Evan's point, he thinks the greatest movie ever written was Adaptation by Charlie Kaufman. And he says this movie was obviously Charlie Kaufman getting to a point where his writer's block, and he's like, oh, I'm going to turn my writer's block into the entire movie. And he's like, when he got there, if he never got to the writer's block, he would have never made this movie. And what he thinks the greatest movie ever written would have never been made. So his whole point is, writer's block isn't something you avoid. It's something you engage and enter into, and that's a part of fostering creativity. Okay? Are you guys following? Okay. So what if we paralleled this idea of a writer's block to like a spiritual journey block or fruitlessness? And I think a lot of us see this time of fruitlessness or this spiritual block, this as impassable and as something we should avoid. But what if it's something we should actually engage and explore? Okay, are you guys following? Okay, so the lectionary text, so I want to now juxtapose fruitlessness with holiness, okay? So the epistle in the lectionary is in 1 Thessalonians, and this is what Paul writes. And he says, and may he so strengthen your hearts in holiness that you may be blameless before God and Father at the coming of our Lord Jesus with all the saints. Okay. So in Jesus' parable, what is our job when there's fruitlessness? Do we muster up more fruit? In his story, we just wait for summer, right? Okay. In this epistle, who's supposed to produce holiness? Is it God or is it us? It's God. We can't produce our own holiness, okay? So I propose that until we come to this point where we exhaust our own efforts of holiness and fruit, unless we get to that point, we can never actually begin to produce holiness. And I want to redefine holiness here. I think we often define holiness as perfection, which is just wrong. Holiness just means different or other or set apart. If you define holiness as perfect, perfection doesn't exist. So if you define it as perfection, you reward those who have willpower, which isn't really good news, and you reward the best actor. You reward hypocrites because perfection doesn't exist. I've heard holiness defined as healing and wholeness, not something you can do yourself, but something that's done to you. And now when we're made whole and when we begin the process of healing, you don't judge others. You have compassion on others. Does it make sense? And so I propose then that this season of fruitlessness and darkness, as scary as it is one of the most important seasons we can enter into. Thomas Merton says it like this. He says, when humility delivers a man from attachment to his own works, his own fruit, and his own reputation, he discovers that perfect joy is possible only when we have completely forgotten ourselves. And it is only when we pay no more attention to our own deeds, our own reputation, and our own excellence that we are at last completely free to serve God in perfection. He's like, that's perfection, when we give that up for his own sake alone. Then he keeps going. A man who is not stripped and poor and naked within his own soul will unconsciously tend to do the works he has to do for his own sake rather than for the glory of God. He will be virtuous not because he loves God's will, but because he wants to admire his own virtues. But every moment of the day will bring him some frustration that will make him bitter and impatient, and in his impatience that he will be discovered. He's acting. He knows he's not perfect. And then he says this. Be content, Vox, all of us, be content that we are not yet saints, even though we realize the only thing worth living for is sanctity. Then you'll be satisfied to let God lead you, to let God put fruit in us, to sanctity by paths that you cannot understand. But this only comes when we travel in darkness, in which you will no longer be concerned with yourself and no longer compare yourself with other men. Do you guys get that? Are you guys following me? So I have two spiritual practices here. So the first one, I never thought I'd use the word Seth Rogen next to spiritual practice, but I'm going to, okay? So the first one is a partner like Seth Rogen. So Tim Ferriss asks Seth Rogen, so what do you do? Like, if you hit that place of block, he's like, well, the thing is, I never write alone. So when I'm stuck, someone else will have an idea. When I'm stuck, someone will push me. So when we're in this season of darkness, when it feels like we're fruitless, it feels like it's pointless, our instinct will be to run from community. That's our instinct. And I implore us, when that comes, to run towards it. Because when we feel like we don't have fruit, when we're out of ideas, when we're not inspired anymore, that's when we need each other the most. All right? That's the first one. The second one is wait and observe like Ansel Adams. I don't know why I made these so cute, but I just did. So the second one, my son Joshua, he's taking a photography class right now at McCallum, and he's doing a project that has to do with studio lighting. And he says it was pretty hard, kind of frustrating. And I know nothing about studio lighting. It just seems impressive and difficult. But in his studio lighting, what he's doing is he's trying to control the light. Right? He's trying to work the strobes and he needs to produce the right amount of light. And I propose that a lot of us, we see faith like that. We think we're in control of our own light and we have to muster and then control the amount of light. When maybe we should be like Ansel Adams, go to the next line, where he just packed his large format camera, hiked up a mountain, stood on a car, I don't know, and he would just wait for hours and hours and sometimes days for the right light to pass. Because he knew that he has no control over the light. He just has to wait and observe it and notice it. And Jesus says, hey, if we're like a fruitless fig tree, just wait. Wait for the summer. All right, let's finish up our text here. So he keeps going, verse 34. And then he says this, be careful or your hearts will be weighed down, like the weight of life. Some of us know what that feels like, with carousing, with inebriation, drunkenness, and the anxieties of life. And that day will close on you suddenly like a trap. You know that weight of life? Have you guys experienced that? We know what that feels like. I remember a couple weeks ago, I was driving Noah to school. So Noah goes to Keeling. We live like a mile away from there. It probably takes 12 minutes to go there and back. So I was kind of sleepy, had just woken up, was still drinking, sipping my coffee. And as I was driving there and back, I had NPR on. And these were the stories that I heard in 12 minutes. It was the day, it was right around the terrorist attacks in Paris. It was the day they killed one of the lead guys who orchestrated it. And they were announcing it like they were celebrating the, like they just killed this guy and they were celebrating it. Then the next story was Paul Ryan was talking about how there should be no more Syrian refugees let in until we figure this out. No more. That was the next story. Then right after that was John McCain saying that our only two options are we fight them. We need more troops because we fight them there or here. That's it. Those are our only two options. So it was like story after story after story. Then the next story was about homelessness in Austin. And then it was starting off by saying, oh, the numbers are actually down. There's like less homeless people. And I was like, oh, finally, a good story. And then it ends the story with, but that's not true because they're not counting the couch surfing homeless folks. And then they interviewed a guy who's been homeless, but just going from friend's couch to mom's couch to aunt's couch. And I remember it was 12 minutes of that. And I got out of the car, walked into the house, and I felt like someone had just punched me in the gut. And I was like, ugh, like that's the world we live in. I was like, are you kidding me? And I remember I just heard Sarah Silverman and she was talking about how depression feels like homesickness. And I was like, oh, that's what that feels like. And I just wanted to lay down. I considered a drink, but it was like 7 a.m. I was like, probably shouldn't start yet. Or I just wanted to nap. I just wanted to inebriate and numb and distract. It was too much. It was too heavy. And I think this is what Jesus is talking about. And he says, don't be weighed down to the point where we find ways to numb. We will find ways to numb. And maybe some of us, it's chemical dependencies, but we all have our beautiful, creative, more socially and spiritually acceptable ways to numb to. In the last 3 weeks, we've been exploring the Enneagram. And to me, this is one of the beauties and the when you start unpacking it, because it can show our strengths and our gifts, but we can use those very gifts sometimes in the shadow to numb and to distract ourselves. So in the last 3 weeks, we talked about heart types and head types and gut types. And so some of us heart types, this is a strength, but we can use these strengths in our shadow to numb. Heart types, maybe some of us will serve others. Which seems like a really, when you're doing it, people are going to be really impressed. That's the thing. But we can use it to numb and to distract. Others of us, we just climb the ladder of success. And we have our own definitions of success, whether it be academic or in workplace or the company you started or whatever it is. But we can do it. It can be a good thing, but we can use it to distract and to numb. Others of us, there's lots of us in Austin, we'll just make beautiful things. We'll carve wood. We'll make paint. And then it's beautiful and amazing, but we can use that same very thing to distract, to numb. Head types like myself, there's some of us, we'll just try to know more. Like more info. I'll just try to understand it and then pontificate more to distract. Other head types are just loyal. And again, people are like, man, that guy is so nice. But we can do that exact same thing to distract and to numb. Or we'll just have fun. And it seems like that guy's not sad. He's having so much fun. Look at all that he's doing. But we'll do that to distract and to deter. And then maybe some of us gut types. We'll just control more things. As long as I'm controlling it, I can avoid. I don't have to really think through it. Others of us will preserve peace. others of us will just be more good. We'll just find what's good and we'll do more of that. And so maybe just a survey here. How many of us think that maybe the serving others, that's us? Okay, some of us. How many of us think it's being successful? Okay, some of us. Being creative, okay? Knowing more, just like learning, understanding more, okay? Being loyal, having fun. I know we like to have fun, right? Being in control, anybody? A lot of us, okay? Preserving peace, as long as nobody's fighting, right? Being good. And for us then, to notice and then to name and then to explore it, to dig a little, when that's happening, what's causing those things to happen? I just watched a documentary. I don't really want to talk about it because I might ruin it. But the Alamo Draft House kind of is distributing it. And Karen and I watched it 2 weeks ago. It's called The Overnighters. Has anyone seen that? Okay. So we watched it 2 weeks ago and the movie ended and we were like, so I'm telling you because we need to talk about it. We need to watch it so we can all talk about it, okay? So I really can't say too much, but the premise of the story is, I think it's in North Dakota and there's a fracking boom. And so all these people are coming for work and there's more work than there is housing. So the church and this pastor decides to open up its doors to house people who don't have homes. And they follow the story of the pastor. So I'll show you the preview. So check it out.
We have people literally walking up to our door from all over the world saying, can you help me?
If it wasn't for this place, we'd pretty much be lost.
How long do we intend to support them?
You see that reaction of people. They look at me like I'm an illegal alien.
They have no intention of building anything here.
So what is community in this place? What are we going to do here?
This is not my home anymore.
Cut the hair. I'm serious.
Did Jesus have short hair?
Jesus doesn't have our neighbors.
This morning, investigators say they know a lot more about the two men they believe kidnapped her.
But you haven't answered a single question. They are being invaded.
I'm the one who's taking the risk here.
You're going to nosedive.
Some things are getting ready to hit the fan.
There was a large manipulation that went on.
I came out here to save my family, and it's probably going to cost my family.
I will not give in to despair because hopeless should never win, and hopeless is a lie.
So when I was watching, you should watch, it's on Netflix, and then we'll talk about it. But when I was watching it, okay, I need to be careful not to say too much here. When I was watching it, my first response to the pastor was, oh, he seems like a good guy. Like, he seems like he's got a vision for the world and community. I like him. Okay. Then I was watching more of it. I was like, oh, this guy doesn't seem to have boundaries. Doesn't really seem like he says no to anyone. And then I kept watching it, and I was like, there's something more going on here. His act of service, there's something under the surface. Okay, I'm just going to leave it at that. But all that to say then, what if in this season, what if one of our spiritual practices is for us to explore darkness, explore our own darkness? I was going to write spelunking, but I thought, I already went cute, so we'll just say explore darkness. And to notice what is it that we do? Maybe some of us, we've got chemical things going on, but to dig a little deeper, poke at it, talk about it. Barbara Brown Taylor says it like this. She's talking about her book, Learning to Walk in the Dark. She says, this is not a how-to book, but if it were, the only instruction would be to become more curious about your own darkness. What can you learn about your fear of it by staying with it for a moment before turning on the lights? Where can you feel the fear in your body? For me, it's my neck. It's like right here. All my fear right here. When have you felt that way before? Keep going. What are you afraid of? What are you afraid is going to happen to you? And what is your mind telling you to do about it? What stories do you tell yourself to keep your fear in place? What helps you stay conscious even when you are afraid? What have you learned in the dark that you could never have learned in the light? And so maybe in this season, and I propose that that's why the church had this season of darkness leading up to Advent. As the days got darker, it's a season for us to do this together and explore it. And then maybe the next spiritual practice, then is let's talk about our coping mechanisms. If we leave these things in the dark, we give power to it. But when we bring it to the light, and there's no shame, there's no judgment, we're all in the same boat. We all have been given the invitation for healing, for hope to be made whole. That's the invitation of Advent. And when we bring it to the light, and when we talk about all of our different coping mechanisms, then I propose that healing can begin. The Zaman, the high schoolers are reading this book. And Brian McLaren, I think he talks about this specific thing. And he's got a chapter about Exodus, and this is what he says. He says, the truth is, we're all on a wilderness journey of some form of slavery. So we're all in this dark space at some point. On a personal level, we know what it is like to be enslaved to fear, alcohol, food, rage, worry, lust, shame, inferiority, or control. On a social level, in today's version of Pharaoh's economy, millions at the bottom of the pyramid work like slaves from before dawn to after dark and still never get ahead. And even those at the top of the pyramid don't feel free. They wake up each day driven by the need to acquire what others desire. And they fear the lash of their own inner slave drivers. Greed, debt, competition, expectation, and a desperate, addictive craving for more, more, more. The wilderness journey, this dark season, is always difficult. It always is. And it seems to last forever. Like kids on a car ride, we keep whining, aren't we there yet? But the truth is, if we arrive before we've learned the lessons of the wilderness, of the darkness, we won't be able to enjoy the freedom that awaits us in the promised land beyond it. There is wisdom we will need there that we can gain only right here. There is a depth of connection with God that will be there when we need it in the future if we learn to trust and follow God now on the long, wild road to freedom. And so what if we Vox together in the season of Advent, we took this invitation and we entered into it together. And I'll just close with this. There's a recent episode of Radiolab. I think it was called The New Normal. Did you guys listen to that? It's actually a replay of an old one 6 or 7 years ago. And the opening story is a philosophy professor, and he talks about an experience he had when he was, I think he was 18 years old, and it was in the 1960s, and he was on an airplane. And he's sitting there on the plane, and there was an older white gentleman next to him. So this is in the 1960s. And the white gentleman, so a black stewardess walks by, and the old white guy goes, "Ugh, not another Negro stewardess." He said that out loud. So he thinks back on that time that happened, and he says it's a really interesting time, because if that man had said it a few years earlier, it would have been normal. But it was 1960s. If he would have said it a few years later, it would have been unspeakable. And then he said this, in that moment when that man said that, go to the next slide, he said, it was like that guy was shouting through an open window between worlds. And when I heard that, I was like, that's Advent. We're in between worlds and we're caught in between, and sometimes we don't know how to live, how to act, and we're shouting through this window. And my invitation to us in these next few weeks is, if we're in this season of darkness, or if we've been there, or if we're scared to go there, go together and drive into the darkness so that we can experience the true beauty of the light. And I'll leave you with these two quotes. Robert Brown Taylor says it like this. He says, I have learned things in the dark that I could never have learned in the light. Things that have saved my life over and over again. So that there's only one logical conclusion. I need darkness as much as I need the light. Gerald May says like this, the dark night is a profoundly good thing. It is an ongoing spiritual process in which we are liberated from attachments and compulsions and empowered to live and love more freely. And so this is my prayer for us. And this is a prayer that Thomas Merton prayed. And may this be our prayer for us in this season. My Lord God, I have no idea where I'm going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end. Nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think that I am following your will does not mean that I am actually doing so. But I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you. And I hope that the desire in all that I am doing, I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about it. And therefore, I trust you always. Though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death, I will not fear, for you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my perils alone. And I pray this in the name of the Father, of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.